To live well, a nation must produce well. In recent years, many observers have charged that American industry is not producing as well as it ought to, or as well as it used to, or as well as the industries of some other nations have learned to produce. If the charges are true, and if the trend cannot be reversed, then sooner or later the American standard of living must pay the penalty. From KUAC-FM in Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. In the next hour, we will look at the criticism of American industry, at the changing marketplace, and at innovations available to the largest manufacturers and the smallest of businesses, innovations that can, and for some, are putting some of the pizzazz back into the American business scene. My guests are William Neal, manufacturing consultant for Hewlett-Packard Company in Massachusetts, and David Hoffman, professor of business administration at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Gentlemen, the indictment of American business and industry is not a singular one. We've been accused in this country of making shoddy products, whether we're talking about industrial or consumer products, of having a workforce that is inefficient, disinterested, and ill-trained, and of having a management force that's out for the quick buck and doesn't pay attention to long-term goals. I know there have been some changes that are happening in this country that put a brighter light on the present and perhaps the future of industry. But first of all, I want to look at these indictments. Bill, I'll start with you. What's your sense of what has gone wrong or what is wrong with American industry? If there's illness, where does it lie?
Well, I think to begin with, we could take a look at what is our basic cultural setup. And what I mean by that is that people are motivated in America on the basis of their role models. And many of our role models and our educational systems are set up so that people focus on the entrepreneur, the one guy, the maverick. All of our heroes are guys who went against the grain, who went out there and did it on their own. And what the real task in business is to unite a team of people towards a common goal, common, consistent operation that goes to work day in and day out and constantly improves itself. Our competitors abroad look in a very much a, instead of an entrepreneurial one guy against the crowd, they look very much at how can the team be a successful, consistent winner in a sustaining effort. Now, we tend to think in terms of finite one-shot goals. You know, I know that even I felt that when I was finishing up my baccalaureate degree, I said, wow, I'm finally done. But in fact, what we really learned today in America is that education and our business are never quite done. There's always a competitor coming around. So there's the how we're motivated. There's the investments we've made by virtue of that motivation in our workplace in terms of if you look at the kinds of investments that have been made in R&D, in the infrastructure, in terms of machinery on the floor, quite recently one of the big announcements in the press was a company that said we are going to spend $1 billion on R&D. We're going to plow back in 8%. Well, that may have been shocking news in the U.S., but frankly, overseas, many of our competitors are plowing in 10 to 12% per year consistently for year after year after year. So there's a renewing force of investment, not just in machinery, but in training. I know in my company, we look at putting in about 20% of an engineer's time into training per year. And I'm told consistently by people that's a shocking amount in terms of how much time we spend of an engineer's time training them. That's the kind of things we're talking about people needing to focus on is how we motivate people, mm-hmm. how we invest in them, and how we consistently invest in our companies.
Okay. David, I want to turn to you. Do you agree with what Bill has to say, and how would you expand on this response to the indictment of American business?
I think that you could find examples in the United States of both tremendous success stories and some real failures. There are a lot of companies in the United States that have learned the hard way, in some cases, that investing in something that isn't tangible yet, or investing in the people, or investing in training, it pays off in the long run. Honeywell Corporation, for example, strongly encourages their people to play with ideas and to come up with innovations, even if it's not specifically focused on what they're doing now. And the classic example of that are those little post-it notes. Mm-hmm. The fellow on the weekends was a choir conductor and got tired of putting slips in the hymnals and went to a friend of his at Honeywell who was a chemist and said, do you have a glue that doesn't work well? And when they originally took the idea to management, they said no. Well, they kept pushing the idea. And of course, everybody has those post-it notes all over their life.
Isn't the story there that it started being, the post-it notes started being used within Honeywell? The people saying, God, Jack, that's a great idea. I want some of those. Can you make me some more?
Well, they were even innovative in testing the market. They produced a prototype batch of them and sent them to the secretaries of the CEOs of the top 500 corporations. And these people immediately saw that there were a lot of uses for them and went back to Honeywell and said, how can I buy many of these? And it immediately recognized that there was a demand for a product that people didn't. You couldn't sense a demand in the marketplace because it wasn't there. But the key to it, the whole idea, was that the company was encouraging people to play with ideas, mm-hmm. and it pays off.
Now back up for me a minute. The original question to you was, what's wrong in American industry? Bill has said, maverick, one-man-only role models that doesn't seem to work anymore, not putting enough money in the resources that can develop, and short-sightedness in terms of education and training. Is there anything else you'd add to that? Because I do want to look at what's wrong first, and then I want to look at what's right.
There's a great deal of pride in the United States that we're individuals, mm-hmm. and that we do things individually. And that is a strength, but when we work with other people in an organization, it can sometimes get in the way because we have to recognize that success for what we do in an organization is a function of what we do collectively. And there are many times and situations where we have to feel a stronger bond with the collective goal and maybe back off a little bit on the individuality so that we can get something done collectively. You know, it's that attitude that what I'm doing here is not just mine, but it's everybody's. And I have pride in everybody's work.
Yeah. You're listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. David Hoffman is with us. He's a professor here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, specializing in business administration. And William Neal is with us from Massachusetts. Welcome, Bill. And is a consultant for Hewlett-Packard. This question may be an extension of the first, but I want to ask you why so many of us in this country tend to buy Japanese, for example, rather than buy American. Is it that we have lost faith? Does the loss of faith come first? Or is it that American products, really, as they've been rumored, have not been up to par? David?
I think that people have, let's just pick automobiles, I guess, as
sure.
an example. People have listened to each other's experiences with regard to buying automobiles, and what the person is buying is not just what is there physically, but how long it lasts and how it feels to them. And people have found that some of the Japanese cars seem to meet their needs because of whatever those qualities are that they were looking for. And we have to be careful to draw carte blanche assumptions that these are good and those are not good. And we've seen a tremendous change in all automobile manufacturers, particularly in the last 3-4 years. And now the difficulties for companies that have lost sales because customers have shifted to their competitors is to get them back, even though their cars may be just as good and may be just exactly what the marketplace wants.
Bill, is there some way in which have we changed our buying habits in the last 20, 30 years as a population? Do we buy for different reasons than we did 20, 30 years ago?
Well, I think we're finding that the customer buys not so much for different reasons per se as our expectations of the fulfillment of those reasons is much greater. I look at the way we bought things 10 years ago, and we made an assumption to a certain degree on the level of quality based on, frankly, the nationality of the product. We used to think that anything stamp made in Hong Kong was pretty cheap stuff. And today, what we've really recognized is that you have to look a little closer, that the product and where it's made may not necessarily imply the standard of quality that you're expecting. What I mean by that now is that people are starting to look closer at how does that door fit? How does somebody when they answer the phone and you ask for service, respond to you. People are starting to notice that and say, gee, I'm frustrated that even though I got a great price on that product, when I call for help, when I can't seem to use the product, I always get, the phrase I hear is, I always get a hassle. So I'm not going to buy from somebody that gives me a hassle anymore. So years ago, where we used to go buy a product, let's say based on, or at least explicitly, we used to buy the product on the price of the product. Today we're saying, you know, every time I go into Fred's grocery store, I always get the feeling that the lettuce is a little dingy and the floor is a little dirty. And Sam's grocery store isn't like that. And I'll start buying lettuce there because I feel that even if the lettuce is the same, I have I'm getting a better product. So I would say that people are starting to recognize, both as producers of product and as buyers, we're all getting a little more sophisticated in our expectations. And so for people in business today, recognizing that is recognizing those trends is an important ingredient in being competitive. I know if you look at some of the great stories now in revival of American competitiveness, you don't just see stories of where people made the product a little cheaper or made it a little longer lasting. You see people with 800 numbers on the back of the product saying, if you've got a question, call us. You see people striving to provide greater service. You see people recognizing that it's price and quality and the service and the features that make people buy those products.
David. A good analogy of that in the service industry is asking people why they fly on a particular airline. We all get delivered from point A to point B and our bags showed up on time, but yet everyone can describe some experience that was either favorable or unfavorable, and they start leaning in one direction or the other. It's not just in the manufacturing fields, but in the service industry. We want those same things.
Features. The seats are too small. I didn't like the food they served me. The flight attendant was not friendly today.
Or the ticket agent didn't accommodate my problem.
Right. Yeah. Let's look at other areas of the marketplace. Is the marketplace changing in major ways from what it has been in the last couple of decades? The fact that it's an international marketplace is one major change, is that right?
It's more and more an international marketplace, and more companies are learning that they have to produce products that they can sell in multiple markets. And that's not easy, because you have to be sensitive to the individual needs and customs of those countries. Would you go to the grocery store and buy a product that was made in Japan if the entire package was in Japanese? Probably not, but there are companies that have tried to do that in the other direction, and it's been a failure. You expect to see the same information that you would get out of a product made in the United States. I think that and the fact that the changes in products and services are changing more rapidly, that the time span between the idea and when it comes to marketplace is getting shorter and shorter, which means that if you don't come up with the next innovation, your competitor is already working on it.
I would certainly say that that's absolutely correct. What this globalization effect has two effects to it. One is that your competitor has access to the markets that you previously held near and dear and or held control of, and the other part is that you now have an opportunity to go compete in a market. However, the hidden gotcha in that is that that market may not have significantly different product requirements, but has significantly different customer buying habits or features. So if I want to market yogurt in the U.S. and over in Europe, that same flavor may appeal, but I've got to relabel it, I've got to package it, I've got to market it to people with very different buying habits.
Because we think about yogurt in one way, and in Europe they may think about yogurt in another way, and you have to accommodate that thinking?
Absolutely. We may eat yogurt in, as part of our diet, let's say, hypothetically, as part of a dessert, whereas perhaps in one culture they eat yogurt for breakfast. Is that something that is only dealt with in marketing? Absolutely not. How we produce and build a product has a lot to do with our ability to make it competitive overseas. If I make American cars built to the body size and features of an American and try and sell that same car as is in a culture where people are either a little taller, a little shorter, have different driving habits or drive on a different side of the road, that means I've got to design that product and market it tuned for that particular market. So it's a it's an effect on the, not only access to new markets, it's an effect that shows access to our markets by our competitors, and it's something that we have to concentrate not just in manufacturing, but in R&D and marketing.
Everything you two are saying has to do with the customer. Is the customer truly the bottom line in 1990? And is this new? Or has this always been so?
I think it's always been there. I think we're just learning to be more careful about how we do it.
I'm thinking that Henry Ford just built Fords. I mean, he built a Model A and a Model T, and they came chunking out, and America lined up to buy them.
But if you bolt the fender on with a half-inch bolt, there's no one in Europe that has a wrench in the English system for doing that.
Yeah, Henry Ford's market, if you will, was very different. Frankly, there were not a lot of competitors per se as there are today. Competitors that provide equal product, equal amount of service, tuned for that specific market. People are more sophisticated today in terms of what their requirements are. They may not seem that way. In fact, it may be difficult to get them to tell you that they have more sophistication. But I think take a look at some industries, for example, like go into your supermarket. Why are there 30 different brands of dishwasher detergent? People have specific requirements for their specific desires, and some of those may not necessarily be just the size of the box or the price of the product. There's the quality and the feel and the appeal of the product to them, as well as the service that the customer gets.
Once again, if you've just tuned in, this is Conversations. Today we're looking at American business in general and a little later in specific. My guests are William Neal from Hewlett-Packard. He is a consultant to that company, located in Burlington, Massachusetts. Mr. Neal graduated with an MS in Systems Management from the University of Southern California in 1982. David Hoffman, a professor of Business Administration here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, took his MBA from University of Alaska in 1972 and his Doctorate of Business Administration from Kent State in 1976. The new realities of this international marketplace, how much do politics play a part? Certainly in the last couple of years, the political face of this globe has changed. Does business have to watch that?
I think so, but I would say that we have to be careful. We have a far greater influence in our companies on our ability to compete in a foreign market than, frankly, many of the federal regulations do, including foreign regulations. If you want a classic example of how somebody who really decided to compete in a foreign market did so successfully, it's been written about in several different documents and books about how the Japanese have been very dominant in the consumer electronics industry. And yet, it was Motorola who managed to build and produce a pager that is now a very dominant market force in Japan. Right on their own home turf, if you will. They didn't do that, frankly, by going and getting a lot of federal regulations changed or modified. They looked at what that market needed, what it desired, and they tuned the entire R&D, marketing, and production capabilities of the company to service that market. And not uniquely that market, they also set up a flexible environment where they could service both that market as well as the U.S. market. They're a very dominant force because of it. So, yes, political changes are having a dramatic effect, for example, the European community, but they are not a crutch that we should say, gee, we can't compete because there's a foreign regulation or our own federal regulations prohibit us from doing that.
Motorola is another good example of a company that puts a great deal of its resources into development and has really carved out several strong niches for itself, and one of those clearly is in the communication area. They're a global leader in communication, and of course they're making central processing chips for a number of computer manufacturers, and their success is linked to the success of those companies. And I think there's some other fields as well that they've been very strong at. I read something just recently that there's a growing interest, and I suspect that Motorola will be one of the leaders in the area of linking computers not by wires, but by radio signals. Well, in order to build anything in the United States that transmits a signal, you need to have approval and authority from the Federal Communications Commission. and authorized frequencies for doing that. So there's always that need to go on the front end, and even if you're not dealing with something internationally, you have to deal with the
regulations,
the limitations on that. I was going to add also that in terms of international markets, especially in the electronics field, not everybody plugs into the same kind of socket with the same type of voltage. Mm-hmm. So to build international products, you have to make sure that they work properly in those countries.
Mm-hmm. I want to look at one more downside issue and then put our efforts for the rest of the hour towards innovations that you see happening nationally and internationally. The one more downside is, at the beginning of this program, I, in my introduction, indicated that if American industry and business didn't improve its competitiveness, didn't improve its business practices, that it was going to alter and negatively our standard of living. If the majority of industry and business in this nation continues to do things the same old way, the way that was established in the 20s through the 50s, how true is that prediction that our standard of living could slip away from us? Bill, I'm looking at you.
Well, I guess to be fair, you're going to find a wide variety of opinions on it. But frankly, I think we all agree that if we lose our ability to develop and manufacture the basis of our goods and services that we use in this country and which we want to export, if we become, if you will, the front office for other people's products which they design and build elsewhere or which they subcontract to be built here, our whole economy becomes determined by the strategic manufacturing plans of other businesses outside the country and other countries' policies towards us. So we fundamentally begin to lose our, if you will, self-determination on where our economy is going. I think that's a very real risk, given the types of joint ventures going on in America today with a lot of foreign companies. And I think it's also a real risk because even if you look at the latest reports that say that we're now have changed some of our production floor productivity growth rates to be the equal to the average of seven or eight nations, great, we're only average. We're not really leading there, and we need to lead if we're going to continue to enjoy the standard of living. And that doesn't mean just that, gee, we'll get to enjoy VCRs and get to enjoy television. I mean basic things like the cost of how much your gasoline and your lettuce and the basic foodstuffs are that you bring home every day from the grocery store. I mean the cost of how much your education and your infrastructure costs, because if your own basis of your economy is not determined by your own goods and services that you build and produce, then other countries' goods and services are going to determine that, and that's going to become the driving force in our economy.
David, is that your sense, that those are the greatest risks and that we could well end up at the hanging on to the tail of our economy rather than driving its front end?
There's a lot of people saying that we're moving into a service economy, mm-hmm. and I think by definition what that means is there are fewer and fewer people working in manufacturing and more jobs opening up in the service area. At one time we were an agricultural nation, but as we moved into manufacturing and heavy industry, it didn't mean that we necessarily stopped producing agricultural products. Where really a lot of the Industrial Revolution paid off was in efficiencies in agriculture. We build equipment that could harvest products. I have a feeling that what we're doing to some extent is we're having a revolution which is putting fewer and fewer people into the manufacturing area, especially for things of high volume that can be fairly automated. And as a result, we're putting more and more people into the workforce in the service area. And where I think that raises the question about the standard of living is that 20 years ago you could work on a factory floor with no education and get a fairly good salary for it on a piece rate. And a lot of those jobs don't exist anymore. And of course, you look at the average salaries of workers in the service district, service fields, a lot of those jobs don't pay as well. And so the concern is that if more of the labor force moves into the service industry, will the salaries drop because of that? It's kind of complicated to answer what the total effect is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was a report that came out and was published in the New York Times first week of February that said that due to I'm going to ask you fellows to flesh it out a little bit for me here, but due to the reduction in the workforce in manufacturing and efficiencies put into manufacturing, our manufacturing is doing much better in 1990 and looks better for 1991. But just as you indicated, David, the white-collar workforce productivity was fairly flat. That's a positive indicator and a negative indicator almost in the same sentence about the American business.
I think you're quite right. The good news side of it was that our productivity growth rate, in other words, the output per unit of time, per hour, say, of a production floor worker had now climbed up to the level of the average of seven other industrial nations, of which most of them you could probably guess off the top of your head, but I can't remember them exactly right at the moment. The point was that while we seem to have, if you will, straightened out the factory floor in terms of helping our production workers do as well as the average of other nations, what we hadn't done is really taken the strategic step to improve the productivity of what we would call white-collar worker. Those people in R&D, those people in what we call manufacturing overhead, all the expediters, all the assistant production managers, they're still dealing with, frankly, with clipboards and pencils, and that's not helping them be really competitive when compared against their counterparts who are more conversant in technologies such as simulation, who use computers to help manage that information and evaluate the data that they have on a day-to-day basis. I know if most of your listeners' desks are like mine, I would say that they're getting an inch more of paper across their desk today than they got 3 years ago on almost a daily basis.
Even with a computer that works without paper for the most part.
Absolutely. So what we've got to recognize there is we've come a good first step, but if we're going to be able to help ourselves out in the long run, we've got to pass those techniques for productivity improvement on into the R&D, into marketing, and frankly into our service businesses. Those people that are answering the phone at a service company, say a real estate agency, and copying down notes on a piece of paper and passing that to their colleague are really not going to be competitive where you've got companies investing in strategic information systems that instantaneously almost allow them to see who the client is, what their buying habits are, where they come from, and what their needs are.
Let's look at some of the innovations. You've probably lost a couple of people in the last 30 seconds, but hang on, folks. You'll catch up with the language, I promise you. Two men, as I understand it, are among the great industrial geniuses of the 20th century. One is from Japan, Dr. Shigeo Shingo. Shigeo Shingo, who died this last year,
November.
81. And then Edward Deming is his Western counterpart. Can you two tell us a little bit about those two men and what made them the geniuses of the 20th century?
Let's start with Edward Deming. The most distinguished award in Japan for quality improvement is the Deming Award. This was an American gentleman who, as an industrial engineer, I think in his background, recognized that we could make significant improvements in the quality of things that we produce in volume through statistical quality control. And he recognized that instead of what's called quality testing, where you inspect something after it's done or at the end of the line, quality assurance is the whole philosophy that you design the product, the process of making the product, the attitude of the people who are there. In other words, you assure quality on the front end with the idea, with the design, with the materials, with the information, and so forth, and you use statistical quality control to assess that. He tried to sell that in the United States, and no one really seemed to be of much interest. Japan was reconstructing and developing its own industries. They recognized this as something that would really pay off. And so there were a tremendous number of companies and senior companies or managers that recognized the value of this. And so he educated them on it. And that's why the Deming Award is considered such a prestigious award, because it's given to that company in Japan, which has made the greatest gains over a year's time.
And this is a revolutionary piece of thinking, that we should ensure quality by starting at the beginning and watching it all the way down to the door as it goes out in the customer's hand.
If you're already making something on a factory floor, there's only so much improvement you can increase by merely going down there and tweaking the equipment and getting the people excited. Obviously, if you're making furniture and the wood is not good grade wood, then there's nothing you can do there. So you need to go to the supplier of the wood and upgrade the quality of the wood. So the only wood that's shipped to you is already good grade, well-dried wood, exactly what you want, no more, no less. And it arrives when you need it, not sooner, not later. And the paint and the materials that go into it and the sequence of assembly, there are a lot of things that could be done to make your furniture as good as possible without any more cost to it. In fact, probably saving costs in the process.
Bill Neal, just a pop quiz to you. David has shown how a furniture manufacturer could create quality assurance all the way through. How could a small firm with no physical product, like a real estate firm or a travel agent or a small grocery store, create quality assurance in their business, adopt Edward Deming's thinking?
Well, some of the things that Deming really stressed, and I'm going to paraphrase some of his efforts, so I won't quote them exactly, is, first of all, set up the work so that you can expect success. Secondly, measure that work. Not so much you can measure the individual's performance per se. We're not on a witch hunt here on individual rights and wrongs. What we are trying to do is set up the work so that the individual has the tools to be able to do that. Let's take, for example, a service type of industry that we've mentioned earlier, the airlines industry. Most airlines, when you dial in now, they can call up your reservation or call up and look at what you've done before with them. Many industries have service centers that when you call in and give them your account number, they can look at your track history of what you've been doing and advise you on, here's a product we think you'd be very interested in. That yields a couple things. One, you're empowering the worker with tools to really do his job. So when I think about it from a real estate perspective, looking at, let's say, a very simple database that allows me to see, if this person's been doing business with me before, where are they located, what kind of house do they... When you first go in, for example, to a real estate agent, you usually sit down and you say, what kind of house are you interested in? Well, rather than have to revisit that notepad every time and only being able to talk to your real estate agent because only they have those notes on that one notepad, if I have that accessible on a centralized or networked type of system, now I not only have people who can respond faster to the customer's needs, but I also have people who are more satisfied that they are able to do their own job, that they have the capability and the tools and the information available to them to service the customer. So I get a double benefit. I get people, frankly, who feel better about doing their work, and I get customers who feel like they're really being responded to in a meaningful way rather than, let us take a message, we'll get back to you.
Well, and this is interesting because if one of the criticisms of American society is that we're forgetting how to be neighbors, we're forgetting how to put the human element into our transactions. And what you're describing from Edward Deming's best advice is to put the human back into it all the way through.
Yes, and I will say one thing that I didn't highlight before is Deming really, as he went on and worked longer in this area, tried to do two things that really to help people do this. One, rather than it just be a somewhat holistic approach, he said measure the things. Measure how many phone calls you have coming in. Measure how much workload you have on your people. Measure the variation of that workload. See how consistently they're able to do their job, not because you have workers that some are slack and some are better than others, but because you want to be able to understand what your customer wants, what your people need to do their job. And last but not least, Deming really looked at it was management's role to lead that change. It was the leader's role to help empower the people with the tools and the training and the skills to be able to do that. He really looked at it as if you want to change, there are many good ideas that can be brought in from people below and from people in the middle management, but it is up to the leader to really authorize and empower those people to make them feel good about contributing.
Today on Conversations, we're talking about American business, what's been happening to it over the last couple of decades and where it's going now. My guests are William Neal, consultant with Hewlett-Packard Company in Massachusetts. He's a co-author of a book coming out in April of 1991. It's called Concurrent Engineering and DFM. That's Design for Manufacturing in the Electronics Industry. Van Nordstrand Press will be the publisher. David Hoffman is with us, professor of business administration at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Among other courses, he teaches production operations management and computer simulation, computers being one of David Hoffman's loves, as I understand it.
Great toys.
Let's talk about Dr. Shingo, a Japanese man considered one of the geniuses of industrial life.
He was given the credit for a lot of the early improvements in Toyota's manufacturing facilities. And was one of the early developers of the idea of just-in-time, JIT, J-I-T. And where a lot of companies end up spending money unnecessarily is that as work moves from one workstation to another workstation, or from one factory to another one, or one piece of an assembly line to another one, you can allow a lot of variation in how fast people work by putting piles of work between them. Well, that adds up to be tremendous amounts of money in what's called in-process inventory. The things you've already invested materials and time in making, but they're really worthless to the marketplace because they're not done. And also it hides inefficiencies in the process by allowing that work in-process inventory. And what Shihigo Shingo suggested was that we more closely integrate these work areas or these factories. In Japan, it's much more common to see suppliers right across the street from who they're selling to. And what moves from one place to another one is just exactly the right amount at that time. So the materials arrive where they're needed just in time. My favorite example of that is one of the companies in Japan receives molten metal where they need it, when they need it, obviously. And so it eliminates a lot of that work in process. Now, there's two philosophical differences about that approach. One is it allows for no variation in work areas, because if there's a delay in one area, it delays a lot of the other areas. Shihigo Shingo said, well, that hides inefficiencies. And he used the analogy of a stream with rocks in it. And what you do is you lower the water level and find the rocks. You raise the water level until you figure out how to get rid of the rocks. You remove them, and then you lower the water level to the point where you can find more rocks. And those rocks represented inefficiencies in the flow. And it also saved quite a bit of money in the process. He also was a developer of a process called Poka-Yoke, which is a philosophical approach that when you find an error or a deficiency, you then approach solving that problem in a way that will see to it that that problem never occurs again, rather than just hiding it or masking it over or just getting things barely up to tolerance. And in his book, one of his stories is a person was assembling an electronic switch that had two springs in it. And every once in a great while, one of those switches would be sent back to the manufacturer defective because one of the springs had not been put into the switch. And so he went to the assembler and he put a dish in front of them. And he said, you put two springs in the dish, you assemble the switch, the dish is empty. You put two springs in the dish, you assemble the switch, the dish is empty. There has never been a switch recalled or sent back to the factory because it was missing a spring. Some of his innovations are really very low tech. And I think what a lot of managers need to realize is that not every solution is something sophisticated or the latest technology. A lot of them are in the minds of the people who are there on the shop floor.
He also had a worker, I think you told me this story, sit and listen to a machine or an engine for half a day.
He was going to operate a piece of machinery, and he wanted that person to know the piece of machinery. Instead of just knowing what the job is, it's much more useful for the person who's doing the job to know what the standards are themselves and to know the piece of equipment. He gave a presentation to some American businessmen once, and he asked them the question, how many of you know how to ride a bicycle? And they all put their hand up. And he said, how many of you know how to fix a bicycle? And only a few hands went up. And he said, that's part of the problem. He said, we have the know-how, but we don't have the know-why. And so we need to know that. Hewlett-Packard is one of the companies which is a leader in the idea of removing foremen or supervisors from the assembly process and letting what were typically their responsibilities, putting those in the hands of the workers.
So that the workers know the know why.
Yeah. Absolutely. What we're trying to do there is two things. One is there's a tremendous benefit in reduced cost if the person who's doing the assembly has a simplified method and it saves him time. But if he also understands why his assembly is important, how it fits into the greater scheme of things, what the standards are to which it must adhere, he can check it himself. You create this assemble, test, and feedback loop that instead of months, weeks, or days long is near instantaneous simply by, one, setting up the structure of the job so that the person has a knowledge of both the assembly and the evaluation of whether that assembly is correct, and you also empower the person to be part of the greater team who has a greater vision of what am I expected to perform, who is the next person down the line, what do I owe them, and how are they part of my team, what is my role in the greater team, as opposed to the more classic approach which says, here's the wrench, go to that place on the assembly line and just keep turning those nuts. Keep tightening that nut, and when it gets too tight, then we'll let you know. That does two things. One, creates a lot more work downstream. Somebody's got to check to make sure that nut is not too tight, not too loose. Secondly, it's very tedious. People get bored. You have a lot of turnover. There's been other studies that are, frankly, much more detailed than what I'm alluding to here that show how that kind of tedious work actually ends up with a lot more indirect costs. People troubleshooting the problem, trying to figure out how to work around it. The indirect costs of greater medical care because tedious jobs like that get people bored and they have stress-related illnesses and that sort of thing. And you'll actually see medical insurance costs go much higher in those kinds of jobs that are structured in that way.
Was there resistance to Dr. Shingo's theories as there was resistance to Edward Deming's theories in the United States? And are companies coming around in addition to Hewlett-Packard?
I think there are a tremendous amount of companies turning around, mostly in the Fortune 500, not out of a sense, frankly, of, isn't this a great idea, an altruistic view of it. Let's face it, we live in a free enterprise society. They see that the demands of the market are requiring them to provide much higher quality. On the order of magnitude changes of higher quality in many of their products, they're seeing that their product development, their acceptable levels of product development time are being required to be cut in almost halves for each successive generation of product. So they see a real need, a real motivation just to be competitive, to remain competitive in world markets, to be driven to these kinds of steps. So there's a real bottom line reason for this. But notice that we're not focusing on the bottom line in terms of what's its effect on the stock price per se today. Mm-hmm. We're looking at it in terms of what additional market shares can I get by improving my product quality and focusing on the why that we talked about earlier. Why is my product accepted the way it is? Why do I have these failures? And looking at what we call the process of how we make the product, looking at improving the process or fixing the process as opposed to the who did this, the whodunit approach, or what I call fixing the blame. We don't get much benefit out of fixing the blame. We degrade the worker. We don't improve the next product that comes down the line. We may even lose talents because of that. Instead, what we're really working on is fixing the process so that we enable the worker to do a better job next time.
And what Bill is talking about is something you brought up earlier, is it not, David? And that's all an overall design for manufacturing that incorporates a number of definitions, blurred job descriptions for one.
I think it all pays off.
Yeah.
And gathering just one little technique or one little idea doesn't do much, but collectively there seems to be a lot that can be done. In terms of getting the people in the process to change their whole idea and attitude about it, imagine the idea of a person doing some work and recognizing that the work has been done wrong, but then being able to willingly stop everything that's going on, saying, I didn't do this correctly. We need to solve the problem so it doesn't happen again. Rather than, it's not right, it's not good enough, but I'll pass it on and everybody else will pass it on. And it'll go out in the marketplace defective. Bill had a visual yesterday in a presentation that showed the relative cost of correcting errors in the design stage versus the manufacturing stage versus letting it go out the door. And it just magnifies. Mm-hmm. The sooner you can catch those, the much less painful it is in the process.
Sure, we see that for every, and this is studies actually done by the National Institute of Science and Technology, as well as some other places. They show that the cost to catch a problem at each successive stage of the life cycle of a product, and I think of stages of life cycle of a product, first R&D, followed by pre-production, prototyping, followed by production, followed by delivering to the customer and its service life. For each successive stage that you catch it later on, you pay an order of magnitude more cost to fix it. So if I catch, to go back to your analogy, if I catch the problem of the wood being delivered faulty at the doorstep before I started to build my chairs with it, I pay much less in terms of service and in terms of labor cost to fix it than if I have a customer call up and say, I just bought this chair two weeks ago and it's already cracked and falling apart. Why is that? There's a lot of effort being put into developing processes to catch those problems earlier on. Not so much in terms of testing per se, but in terms of how do I convey the customer requirements back all the way what we call upstream, and getting people to work together to solve those problems when they first are designing the product.
Rather than allow that defective board to come into the plant, they shouldn't even cut down the defective tree in the first place, because moving it to their plant and finding it defective is a waste of resources.
So in some ways, that what you just said is calls people to bring the forest, psychically at least, closer to the plant, so that the person who owns the manufacturing plant is in communication with the guys who are cutting trees, talking to them about what they want, how they want it, when they want it.
Sure, I would go to my paint supplier and work with them on specific quality specifications for the paint, so that they know exactly what standards I want, and then the only thing that they will bring to me is that grade. It's common to have supplies not only arrive at a factory, but the person who brings them, they bring them right into the factory and put them right on the location where they're at, so they're not moved twice.
I guess the thing that I would point out that makes that very different from our previous approaches is, instead of optimizing, let's say, our painting capability of that plant, or optimizing the real estate agent's desk per se, what I'm trying to do is integrate the real estate agent with the whole rest of the business, integrate my suppliers and my production facility. And by that, what I'm doing is I'm looking at how information, work, and product flow through my company, regardless of whether that's a real estate agent or a lawyer's office or a wood products company or an automobile manufacturer or electronics company. What I want to do is integrate the information and tasks so that I only do the task once, and I do it then in the most efficient way I can.
I think a good analogy of that would be, imagine real estate agencies integrating that information flow with the financial institutions involved. And if that real estate agent closes 500 houses that year, they've closed all 500 of them on time without a single error.
Imagine that.
There's no reason why it can't be done.
You've indicated some of the role of management. What's the most important thing you think a manager or an owner, CEO, has to do today to make sure that his or her business is running the most efficiently, most effectively?
Well, I have to say, in fairness to your listeners, that my experience of graduating from one of the military academies certainly gives me a vision of leadership external to private business as it's usually practiced today. And I would say that the biggest difference I see from my experience is that I'll call it the business manager today needs to recognize that his primary goal is in the coaching of his people to be successful. What I mean by that is, in terms of coaching, I mean in terms of establishing a shared vision with a quantifiable measurement to it. A lot of people will say, my boss keeps telling me he wants more out of us this year. He wants more out of us this year. Well, the analogy I use to that sort of thing is that if you look at, for example, the Super Bowl, the coaches on the sideline sat there or stood there and told their players, watch out for this. Here's what to do next. Help your teammate this way. I want you to run that play. Conversely, most American businesses today are staying there with that, if you want to use the coach analogy, with I want 6 points on this play. I want 6 points on this play. I want 6 points on that play. And the point is that only serves to, frankly, not give a unified goal to people that is achievable and makes them more nervous. Instead, what we're seeing real leadership do is establish a vision. For example, we want to be the best service provider in the city of Fairbanks to our customers, and that's why they'll keep coming back to us. We want to ensure that our customers never have a complaint about the service we provide. There is a quantifiable strategic vision that is sustainable regardless of whether you're making paper cups or real estate deals or a lawyer's office. And that's the kind of strategic vision. And then last but not least, we make it quantifiable. We start to talk to our customers and say, how do you look at a real estate agency? What is important to you about that? Is it that we quickly respond to you? Is it that you always get to look at the houses that you've told us you want to look at? Is it that you get the lowest price? And you develop an understanding on each member of the company's part on what the customer really wants. That requires a lot of coordination. It requires a lot of time spent, frankly, in getting communication to go not so much horizontally, not so much vertically up and down for, gee, boss, will you sign on this requisition, but a lot of communication horizontally between real estate agent A and real estate agent B, between law clerk A and the lawyer B. That kind of what we call horizontal frontline communications that Tom Peters talks about in a lot of his books, for example, on Thriving on Chaos. That is the real flow we're trying to make happen so that people can really start to see tremendous benefit and ownership and pride in what they're doing.
This is what you'd call a more decentralized business place, yes?
I think to a great extent it is. Bill and I were talking yesterday afternoon about the horror stories everybody have. I need to spend $50 on something. Well, you've got to get this person's signature, and then it has to go up to this person's approval and that person's approval. A tremendous amount of time and effort is wasted just getting signatures. Why not let the person who's making the decision that they need something to have some degree of authority to make purchases? There's the need. They spend the money.
Yeah.
It solves the problem. And that type of decision in an organization clearly reflects decentralization, because you're giving spending authority, you know, which was the magic hatchet, I guess, for many companies, down to where the decision should be made in the first place. And there are ways to figure out the limits to that.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today with David Hoffman and with Bill O'Neill. We're talking about American industry. There is at least one final topic I'd like you both to look at before we close this hour in the next 10 or so minutes, and that's the education of our workforce. Bill, the other day you mentioned that Hewlett-Packard has been developing a smart PC so that if the workforce that comes to use that computer is less educated, less able to use a sophisticated machine, that Hewlett-Packard will be prepared with a machine that suits that person's interests. That struck me as rather frightening. Smart on Hewlett-Packard's part, but frightening in terms of the education of the workforce of this country. What are your thoughts about this country's workforce and what kind of educational needs it needs?
Well, first let me clarify a few things. One is in terms of technology there. What we're trying to develop is tools and computer systems which enable people to utilize them very rapidly, very readily. Instead of requiring to read pages and pages of instructions, we're trying to provide systems that allow people to look at things as graphs, as pictures, as icons, and point and click, if you will, mm-hmm. or point to something and choose it as choosing a symbol rather than have to read a bunch of lines of text. That's not unique to Hewlett-Packard. There are many companies trying to do that. That is certainly something that we see going far beyond the PC. So all of our systems are oriented to that. And it's not to take the place of the disadvantaged worker or the unknowledgeable worker. It's frankly to allow people to be more productive and enable them to use information more readily. I know that when we all first started using computers, we spent hours programming them and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We don't have that amount of time. That approach is not going to take the place of educating our workers, because first and foremost, that allows the worker to gain access to information not replace is evaluative skills. So I need to have workers on my production floor or working in my law office that have good reading, writing, and evaluative skills. I need to have people who can utilize information readily. The focus that we're really trying to present to people is that information readily accessible in forms that they can readily use it when they want it. So I would say it's not a focus to replace the worker, it's a focus to help the worker get access to information. He needs to do his job. But the quid pro quo to that is that we need workers in the workplace who have good reading and writing skills. We have people. We need people desperately who have good math and science skills as well.
David, any thoughts on educating the American worker? What's necessary for the 21st century?
I agree with what you're saying, and I always think about the fact that I'm part of the last generation that had to learn about computers as adults, and it tickles me to see small children approach computers with the same zeal they approach just about everything else. It's a given. It's there. Now, how do I turn it on? But the computer itself is not an answer to those problems. We still need to have workers that have absolutely right reading and writing skills and computational skills. Where I hope the computer will play a greater role is as a tool to help people learn to do those things rather than a substitute for any of those. Because even as I look at college students in quantitative courses using computers, figuring out exactly what the problem is still done between the ears. It still requires the thinking, and it always will. And whatever came out of the computer as the magic numbers or the set of numbers or the set of visuals, it's still up to the individual to interpret that and then act on it and communicate it to someone else. The person will always still be in that decision-making loop, but I'm hoping the computer serves one as the educational tool on the way to a profession, and secondly serves as an efficiency tool or productivity tool in not just manufacturing but in service areas as well. Airlines, again, to go back as an example, what was it like to make plane reservations before any of the travel agents or airlines had terminals? I think they got on a telephone and called someone. And you're lucky if it all got done correctly.
What a difference.
Yeah, I think some good examples that people can relate to in their daily lives are things like ATMs, where you need to be able to read and follow and press buttons to get cash to go buy your groceries. The typical engine diagnosis tool today that many of the major manufacturers are providing to gas stations are computerized test systems. Many of the states that require certain testing of your emissions, for example, that's done using a computerized tool. We need people today, not just computer scientists, not just the people that are going off to study in the academic community, nor the scientists working in private business. We're talking about the average human being who's going to go out and buy his groceries and work in, like most of us are, on a day-to-day basis in with computerized things as common as VCRs and ATMs and things of that nature.
Is the next century going to be as astounding as this one was? I mean, if you stop and think that most of the things that are present today were not present in the 1900s.
Well, I have an interesting anecdote that I think could illustrate, I think, how astounding it was. My grandfather, who I thought was a marvelous man, had the pleasure of living and starting his life before the motor car or the automobile was invented, and lived to see the day where man stepped on the moon. And that is a tremendous amount of change to absorb socially. It's a tremendous amount of change to absorb technologically. And yet, I also look at the fact that when I graduated from college, most of the technology, most of the products that I was going to work with 8 years later when I first arrived at Hewlett-Packard had not even been invented. So I think we're going to see a dramatic amount of change. And if I were to say to anybody, how would I prepare for the next century? My feeling is read. Look at and teach your children to read. I know that everybody's lives are busy. The thing that we should do is encourage our children to read as much as possible, as wide, diverse an area as possible. I know we all have lead busy lives, so I'm not going to try and utopianly say to somebody, take another half hour out of your day. But what I am going to say is, encourage your children to look and learn, and reading is one of the best ways to do that. So I would really strongly encourage people to encourage your children to look at education not as a a one-time or not as a thing I do from 8 to 5, but learning is a lifelong experience.
Bill Neal, David Hoffman, thanks very much for joining us on Conversations, an hour today on American Business. We hope you'll join us again next week.